This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
No fluff, no guessing. When CFA Charterholder is on that resume, it means something real. Intensive study, tough exams, relentless drive, true grit, a strong network. Hiring managers get it instantly. The CFA Charter is more than letters after a name. It's proof of discipline, resilience, and integrity under pressure. It shows who you are before you even walk in the room. Explore what the Charterholder Advantage looks like at cfainstitute.org.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
I'm David Ronovich. This is The Briefing Room, where we get briefed on a big issue by the top experts in just 28 minutes. This week, the consequential saga of the Trump era reaches the law courts. And this is just on the first set of charges the former president, and would-be president again, faces. Is it a witch hunt, as Republicans claim, or the wheels of justice getting into gear without fear or favour? And what might it mean for next year's presidential election? If you were digging for titanium on Alpha Centauri, you might have missed Tuesday's appearance by former US President Donald Trump in a court in New York to face criminal charges. Earth dwellers who witnessed it, however, might be forgiven for getting lost in the hubbub of claims, counterclaims, takes and prognostications that surround Trump's current legal troubles. So what exactly is he up against? And what's the best guess on how it may all affect next year's presidential election? Step into the briefing room, and together we'll find out. First of all, the Stormy Daniels case, the one that led to Trump's court appearance earlier this week. Anthony Zerka is the BBC's North America correspondent. Anthony Zerka, Stormy Daniels and Donald Trump, where does this story begin?
It begins in July of 2006 at a charity golf tournament in Lake Tahoe, Nevada, where Donald Trump met an adult film star. Her name is Stephanie Clifford, but her screen name is Stormy Daniels. And there's a photograph of the two of them together there. What Stormy Daniels says is that after they met, they went back to Donald Trump's suite at the resort, and they had sex.
When does it first begin to become a problem for Donald Trump?
It first starts bubbling up about 5 years later in 2011. Donald Trump had gone from being a reality television star and business tycoon to contemplating more seriously entry into politics, and he was considering running for president in 2012. And Stormy Daniels begins trying to shop around her story of an affair that she had. She didn't get a lot of takers, but there was one magazine that expressed some interest and interviewed her. And then Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer and all-around fixer, threatened to sue this magazine, and they buried the story, although Stormy Daniels did talk to a gossip website and said that was when the first reports of this came out. But Donald Trump didn't run for president. No one really paid all that much attention at the time, and things went on about their merry ways once again.
In that case, why did it then become big, and when did it become big?
It became big in 2016 when Donald Trump actually was running for president, not only running for president, but doing so very successfully. But in October of 2016, if you'll recall, there was the Access Hollywood tapes that came out that showed Donald Trump making derogatory comments about women and about imposing himself on women. And at this point, Stormy Daniels once again began circulating her story, looking for someone who would pay her to tell her story. And at that point, Michael Cohen got wind of it. At first, the National Enquirer was going to try to buy the story, but that fell through. So Michael Cohen himself paid Stormy Daniels $130,000 for her to keep her silence. And once again, the story went away and no one heard about it until after Donald Trump was elected president.
Can I just get clear? Was Stormy Daniels offered the money or did she say, give me this and I'll go away?
She was offered the money. This was something that Michael Cohen decided to do that would arrange her silence. And it wasn't apparently the first time that Michael Cohen had done something like this, had found someone shopping an embarrassing story and then paid in order for that person to remain silent and not reveal the story.
So where did the money actually come from that was paid to her?
The money came from Michael Cohen. He took out a home equity loan on his house and then used that $130,000 that he had built up in equity on his house to pay Stormy Daniels.
Wow. So how did he get the money back?
His account of this is that he came to Donald Trump in 2017 in the White House after Donald Trump had been elected president, and they discussed the payment to Stormy Daniels. They discussed that he needed to be reimbursed. And at that point, there is documented evidence that Michael Cohen began receiving payments, some from a trust that Donald Trump had set up, some from Donald Trump's banking account directly, that not only compensated him for the $130,000 that he spent, but an additional amount of money that would cover taxes and make it easier for him to declare it as income and withhold taxes and pay taxes on it.
Right. Now, when did this story first become public?
April of 2018, the Wall Street Journal published an article breaking this. So this was the year after those payments to Michael Cohen went through. Originally, Michael Cohen denied it. Donald Trump also denied it, said he was unaware of any kind of a deal. Although in comments made to reporters a month later, Donald Trump said he paid Cohen a retainer, but this wasn't campaign related. Michael Cohen eventually changed his mind a few months later in August 2018. After being investigated by federal prosecutors, he said no, in fact, that these were reimbursement payments for the payment he made to Stormy Daniels. And that's when he pled guilty to a number of counts, to tax evasion, to campaign finance violations, and to lying to Congress about another related thing, but lying to Congress in an attempt to protect Donald Trump.
And Cohen got sent to prison.
He was sentenced to 3 years in prison. He has since been released.
So why has this resurfaced now?
The city of New York, the district attorney's office, was following a series of investigations into Donald Trump and Donald Trump's business empire. Originally under the district attorney Cyrus Vance, and then under Alvin Bragg, who replaced Cyrus Vance in 2021. And they did not bring charges on some of the more complicated criminal cases about Donald Trump's business empire. But Alvin Bragg continued to pursue this investigation into misrepresenting the business filings in relation to these reimbursements or payments to Michael Cohen and the potential that they were more serious than just filing inaccurate paperwork, but they were done so as a way to cover up campaign finance crime that Michael Cohen had committed. He had a grand jury investigating this. The case was referred to as the zombie case because it never seemed to die. It kind of ground along for quite some time without any kind of obvious results until just a few weeks ago when there were indications that the grand jury was reaching its conclusion, that they had asked Donald Trump if he wanted to testify, which is something that comes towards the end of a grand jury investigation. It looked like they had gathered all the evidence, heard all the witnesses that they were going to hear. And that's when Donald Trump posted on a social media account that he thought he was about to be indicted. And of course, although it didn't happen when Donald Trump predicted, it happened just about a week later.
Actually, that takes us up to this Tuesday's courtroom appearance. When he did appear, what was he actually charged with?
What we learned was that there were 34 counts of falsifying business records in the first degree. Now, 34 sounds like a whole lot, but if you read through this indictment sheet, every single time Donald Trump made a payment to Michael Cohen back in 2017, every time he recorded that payment or someone in Donald Trump's business empire recorded that payment into a ledger, that constitutes a criminal violation. And the reason why these aren't misdemeanors, which is low-level crimes, which is what falsifying business records normally are, is because, according to Alvin Bragg, the district attorney who brought this case, this falsification was done in connection with a more serious crime. And that more serious crime was the campaign finance law violation that Michael Cohen committed when he paid Stormy Daniels the $130,000 without properly disclosing it as a campaign contribution, as money spent in order to help Donald Trump's presidential campaign. You have to remember about campaign finance law in the United States. I think most people know you can spend a lot of money on presidential and political campaigns in the United States, but there are disclosure requirements that when you spend that money, you have to make an accounting of it as helping this campaign, and then the accounting is made public. What Michael Cohen did was he spent this money, which the federal prosecutors said was explicitly to help Donald Trump's presidential campaign, but he didn't disclose it as such. And because he didn't do that, he violated campaign finance law. And so what Alvin Bragg, the New York City District Attorney, has done is said these payments by Donald Trump to Michael Cohen were for something that was itself a campaign finance crime. And that's what makes this a more serious charge. These aren't just misdemeanors. They're felonies that could conceivably come with up to 4 years of prison time, although no one thinks even if Donald Trump were convicted of all these counts, he would serve any time in prison.
Anthony Zerker. For Donald Trump, legal cases come not as single spies, but in battalions. To take us through them, we have Renato Mariotti, a legal affairs columnist for Politico magazine, a former federal prosecutor, and host of the It's Complicated podcast. Renato, we've heard a lot about the current New York case. How many other lawsuits is Trump currently facing?
More than you could imagine. He is facing a civil lawsuit by the New York Attorney General. He is also facing a lawsuit by E. Jean Carroll, who claims that he had raped her years ago. He's also facing criminal actions in a number of jurisdictions. There's a grand jury investigation in Fulton County, Georgia. And there are also Department of Justice federal grand jury criminal investigations as well, at least two of them.
Okay, let's go through these one at a time. The sexual harassment and rape case first.
Sure. So E. Jean Carroll claims that she was raped by the former president many years ago, and she has sued him for that. She's also sued him for defamation because he had claimed that this didn't happen publicly while he was president of the United States. Those lawsuits are proceeding and, you know, I think have resulted in some embarrassing details for the former president. The only issue there is monetary, but obviously there's a reputational risk for him as well.
Right. What about the Capitol riots cases?
That's a federal Justice Department investigation. And that's serious because there isn't evidence that we know of publicly that he was involved in planning or coordinating the assault on the Capitol. There's evidence that he incited the rioters who attacked the Capitol. In addition to that, there are efforts that he was involved in with some dishonest lawyers in the United States to try to overturn the result of the election in the United States Senate by having false certifications of votes that were to be certified or not to certify lawful electoral votes. So I do think there is some, you know, significant potential criminal liability for him there.
And where's that case going on currently?
That is not a file. That is an investigation, a criminal investigation that could, in the District of Columbia, where the capital of the United States is, that could result in a criminal indictment.
Right. Now, the other one about 2020 election meddling is the one you mentioned in Fulton County, Georgia. Where are we with that?
Well, the special grand jury has made recommendations. It certainly appears that those recommendations were to file charges, but charges have not yet been filed. They could be filed in the upcoming weeks.
And remind us what this one is about. This is the one where he called the guy in Georgia and said he wanted him to find 11,000 votes, is it?
Exactly right. He called not only that individual, the Georgia Secretary of State, but he called other Republican officials in Georgia and tried to get them to overturn the results of the election there.
Right. And what about the classified documents? Where are we with that?
Well, that's another criminal investigation, this by the Justice Department in the District of Columbia. That case may also be brought in Florida, possibly, because that's where he held the classified documents. But I think that's the most serious case that the former president is facing. Very serious criminal jeopardy for him there.
Now, have we missed anything out so far?
Well, I will just say the former president is facing so many legal troubles that I can't possibly consider all of them on this call. One that we haven't talked about that's, I think, important is the New York Attorney General has filed a civil case that would result in potentially the Trump Organization not being able to do business in the state of New York. So that would obviously have a very significant impact on his business And that is ongoing as well.
Okay. I think you may have hinted at the answer to this question, but if you were him, which would you be most worried about? Which case would cause you most sleeplessness?
Yeah, I would be the most concerned about the Justice Department federal criminal cases, particularly the Mar-a-Lago documents case. It's very hard to defend his behavior there. He took classified documents, willfully held them, even though the government really wanted them back. And there's substantial evidence that he was involved in an obstruction of that federal investigation.
Why do you say that's the most serious? Is it because the penalty for that kind of action is one of the most serious penalties available across these range of prosecutions?
Well, I think that's one reason. This is a criminal case and there are substantial penalties there, but also the evidence is very strong. So in a criminal indictment like the one that just was filed in New York, the prosecution has to prove the state of mind of the defendant. They have to prove, you know, his intent or knowledge. But in the Mar-a-Lago documents case, it's pretty clear, given the facts and circumstances, that Mr. Trump really wanted to keep those documents, that he knew that they were there and so on, because the Justice Department wrote him letters and sent subpoenas and made personal visits to get the documents back. So, you know, I think that that case is just also very straightforward to prove as a legal matter.
Right. The New York case had its legal origins over half a decade ago. How long will these other cases take to prosecute?
Well, it's a great question. I don't know for sure. I think that the Justice Department cases will likely get brought some point this year. But even if the cases are filed, and if they are filed, it's possible they won't result in charges. But if they do, I think the actual criminal cases would last far beyond the 2024 election. And I feel the same way about the Manhattan case.
And what do you think about the strength of the New York case?
I think it's got problems with it. I think it's a reasonably strong case because the statute at issue is relatively straightforward for the Manhattan DA to prove up. But there are legal and factual challenges with the case that will make it more difficult than a number of these other cases that we've talked about.
But you wouldn't make a prediction on it?
No, I think it's too early to make a prediction, in part because the charging document from the Manhattan DA was very vague, did not specify their theories and even some of the statutes involved. And we also don't know the evidence that the Manhattan DA has at this point.
Renato Mariotti. Trump and his supporters argue that all of this is a political witch hunt. Is there some truth to that? And what, as far as can be forecast, is the likely impact on the next presidential election to be held in the autumn of next year? Joining me now in the briefing room are Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri, Director of the US and the Americas Program at Chatham House, and Dr. Mitchell Robertson, Associate Lecturer in US History at University College London. Leslie, I want to test two propositions that I've heard from either side of the spectrum. The first is that these cases, particularly the New York one, really, are politically motivated prosecutions that only Trump would face. And the other is that actually there's been timidity in prosecuting a powerful man where a less powerful person would have been facing justice ages ago. Do you think either of these are correct?
I think you've got to really distinguish between an act being perceived to be political or having a political effect. Undoubtedly, the charges that were announced are going to have a political consequence. But to say that because somebody's appointed through a political process means that their decisions are therefore politically motivated, that's a rather large gap, and I think one that doesn't hold up. You know, Supreme Court justices, now this is a difficult time to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court, but nonetheless, Supreme Court justices have always been nominated. There's a rigorous process, but they are nominated by presidents who are of a political party, and then they're there for life, in part to give them independence. I think there's certainly a lot of truth in that second proposition. It's a very high-stakes case to take on a former president who's already put himself up for the Republican nomination as a hopeful candidate. And who has got so much visibility. And in this case, it's not only the level of the person, it's the individual, Donald Trump, who, as we know, is volatile, who's already shown that he's willing to play politics with democracy and democratic processes in the United States. So it would always be very high stakes. There would always be a great deal of awareness that you better get it right if you're going to go for somebody at this level. So I think that's certainly the case.
Mitchell Robertson, as a historian, you can take a longer view of this process. People talk about this as being unprecedented, but unprecedented is a word that is thrown around. Just how significant is this in terms of American history?
The immediate incident that comes to mind is Watergate, where Richard Nixon was facing criminal charges when he was president. Now, the key distinction there between Nixon and Trump is that Nixon's political career was over. So Nixon was pardoned by President Ford, his successor, who said that someone has to put an end to the Watergate saga and he could do it. This is so unprecedented because Donald Trump is not just a former president, he is the front runner for the Republican nomination in 2024.
So you mean one aspect of the unprecedented nature of this is that no one can actually put an end to it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the former president is facing so many legal challenges. It's not the case that one figure could pardon, as President Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, because he was only facing federal charges. Donald Trump's facing criminal charges in New York, facing accusations of them in federal court and also in Georgia.
Okay, let's move on to look at the political implications. Leslie, has there been any polling done since the Stormy Daniels charges were brought?
There has, and what we've seen is that certainly amongst Republican primary voters, that Donald Trump has benefited in the short term. He was, you know, running neck and neck. It was at times behind DeSantis. Now he's well above DeSantis, the other likely rival to Donald Trump when it comes to getting that nomination. There's a real question, right, whether that spike will continue or whether that's a short-term bump. The public hasn't seen very much. They've heard the charges now. They knew that there were indictments. There's sort of a rally round the former president effect that's going on right now. And we're seeing it in the polling of people. We're seeing it in leading contenders, both announced and likely for the Republican nomination in the next elections. And we're seeing it, you know, broadly across the Republican Party. But this is, you know, a very clear calculation. I would argue that any nominee is going to want those base voters to be on their side. Going against the former president at this point in time on such a high stakes issue would be politically unwise. And it is unprecedented. I think there is a lot of concern or question mark about what can you do this? Should you do this? Is it the right thing for the country? But the end result is that right now, Donald Trump is riding a wave. I suspect what we'll see in time is that people will grow tired of it, that it will go on and on. And that the other thing that we're likely to see is more cases come to light. If the Georgia process is, if there are actually an indictment and charges, if the Department of Justice proceeds, suddenly it all starts to look a little bit different. And as we move forward, we're going to be closer into primary season, edging up against those elections. Remember that the next hearing right now in New York is not scheduled to be until December. So this is a very, very long process, and people's attitudes will change over time.
Mitchell, there's a very real possibility that he will be in court appearances at the same time as appearing in some of the early Republican primaries.
Absolutely, if it plays out according to the current timetable that's been put forward.
How would you see this if you were somebody like Ron DeSantis, who, as Leslie said, is the front runner, other than Trump, to be Republican nominees, the governor of Florida? What do you understand to be his feeling about what's happening with Trump right now?
Well, it's an interesting one to speculate on. I think if you're not the favorite to be the nominee, what you need is airtime. And what this has done is put Donald Trump front page on leading the news. And that's not good news for Ron DeSantis. If DeSantis needs to get his message out, he can't do that in a way in which Donald Trump has sucked up all the oxygen. I mean, this is exactly what happened in 2016, and it perhaps happened in 2020 as well. All the attention, all the focus is on Donald Trump. We could look at what Ron DeSantis is saying today, but is anybody actually listening to that?
Leslie, is that broadly how you see it as well, that this has created a real problem? We'll come to the Democrats in a moment. It's created a real problem for Trump's rivals.
Well, it certainly has for now. And again, this is an immediate effect. These charges were only announced on Tuesday. So it's a very short-term, immediate bump. And this would be the wrong time for those who would like to take Donald Trump on in the primary to really make it known. There's a lot of public sympathy amongst Trump's base. And again, the Republican Party, as it's currently cast, absolutely any contender for the nomination is going to have to hold on to that base.
Mitchell Robertson, I think we should be clear here. We've talked so far about the polls strengthening Donald Trump with Republican voters in the primaries. Do we have any evidence about what it's doing for, let's say, swing voters who might decide the next election, presidential election?
Yes, absolutely. And it's really important to dig into these numbers, because often what the overall electorate says is different to what Republican voters have said. If we can think about questions about, is Trump honest? that number is amongst 65% for Republican or likely Republican voters. It's at 29% amongst all voters. Now, the trick is with Donald Trump is these numbers so rarely change. You know, he's whether he was honest, sort of sat in the 30s for his entire presidency. Nothing much really seems to change the needle. Another question that might be worth looking at is this idea of the prosecution being a witch hunt, something that Donald Trump has certainly embraced. Now, that resonates very well with Republican voters. I've seen polls that suggest 80% agree with that sentiment. Obviously, that's not the case amongst Democrats, but more importantly, amongst independents, 51% said the charges were fair compared to those who thought it was a witch hunt. So that messaging doesn't seem to be resonating with swing voters.
Leslie, if you were Joe Biden, would you prefer Trump or DeSantis to be your opponent?
Oh, I think that the Biden campaign rightly would say they won't speak to this issue. Mm-hmm. But if they were to speak to this issue on the record, I think they'd say Donald Trump, because what we've seen is that Donald Trump has presided over elections that haven't gone well, not least in the most recent presidential election, also in the midterm elections. And he's a proven loser for the Republican Party. And so I think that, you know, President Biden is staying in so far. He hasn't formally announced, but it looks like I'm sure he will run again. And if Trump becomes a candidate, I think the expectation is, you know, as we've just heard, that the moderate Republicans, independents will break away once again from Donald Trump. They'll move towards President Biden, vote for him. And that's a win for the Democrats. DeSantis, I think, you know, people are waiting to see, right? If he were to become the nominee, it potentially, you know, becomes a real competitor. Some people think that this is a man who's, you know, very popular in the state of Florida, in large part because it's a sort of clean, high-functioning state. It stayed quite open during the pandemic, but that his, you know, doesn't have the charisma, doesn't have the leadership to play on a national stage. So there are lots of questions, you know, about DeSantis. But broadly speaking, it's Trump that I think the Democrats feel they could certainly defeat at the ballot box.
Mitchell, if Trump is found guilty on any of these various charges, can he still run for president?
Absolutely. None of them would be disqualifying. Indeed, we've already had a candidate run for president from prison. Not a major party candidate. This is Eugene Debs, the socialist candidate, but he certainly could run. There's nothing in any of these charges that would prevent him.
A legendary socialist candidate from the 20s?
Yes, indeed, 20s.
Right, okay. So he can run. Leslie, could he actually be behind bars and still be president?
It's quite difficult to imagine a sitting president serving from behind bars. I'm sure that the party would exercise its authority under different parts of the U.S. Constitution to declare a president who was behind bars unfit for office. This is something, if you remember back to the days of Donald Trump's presidency, that was discussed quite a lot. And of course, there's the possibility that there would be yet another. He could be the one president who was impeached for a third time. But again, this is really stretching the imagination, because there's nothing to demonstrate. And, you know, never mind Trump's base, never mind even the Republican Party, go to national elections. Donald Trump was defeated in 2020. He lost the popular vote in 2016 by around 3 million or more votes to Hillary Clinton. He lost the overall vote in 2020. His party performed far worse than it should have done, set against a historical standard in the midterm elections. So the possibility that he sort of rocks up on the back of charges, perhaps a conviction, and becomes a successful candidate in 2024 seem extremely unlikely, not something that one shouldn't be wary of and attentive to, but certainly very unlikely.
Mitchell Robertson.
There's been a precedent from the Office of the Legal Counsel, it's in the Justice Department, a memo from 1973, and that was cited during Trump's presidency as basically the precedent, not the law, but the precedent that a sitting president couldn't be prosecuted. And it says, criminal proceedings against a president in office should not go beyond a point where they could result in so serious a physical interference with the president's performance of his official duties that it would amount to an incapacitation. Now, I wonder whether that might be something that could come into play as well.
Mitchell Robinson and Leslie Vinjamuri. And my thanks to them and to Anthony Zerka and Renato Mariotti. And my conclusion, America seems to be living through times when the word unprecedented is applied every few weeks to its political life, and not in a good way. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Isabel Goff. The editor was Richard Varden and the programme was mixed by James Beard. If you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, where you'll find a whole back catalogue to listen to, including the one about how worried we should be by avian flu, the one about the Wagner Group, and the one about how we get over 50s back to work, or whether we should even try.
Hello, I'm Lucy Worsley, and I want to tell you about Lady Killers from BBC Radio 4. It's a programme that mixes true crime with history, but with a twist. With our all-female team of experts, I am re-examining the crimes committed by murderesses in the past through the eyes of 21st century feminists. What can we learn from these women, and would it be any different today? Lady Killers. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.